some people write like from the beginning to the end, I sort of can't do that. I have to make it, for me, like perfect. So I keep going over the beginning because it's all about the rhythm and melody for me.
Welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell, and that was my guest for today, the comedy writer Robert Popper. At the moment, Robert is most associated with the Channel 4 sitcom Friday Night Dinner, about a Jewish family who get together every Friday night with hilarious consequences week in, week out. He's done 6 series of that for Channel 4 and it's very funny, but he also had a very distinguished career before that, often dealing in surreal and absurd comedy. He wrote Look Around You, which was a sort of cult hit of the early 2000s. He did that with Peter Serafinowicz. And if you haven't seen that, I definitely would recommend looking it up. It's the two series are quite different to each other. The first one is spoof science documentaries in the style of the documentaries that were shown in schools in the 1980s. It's very weird and very, very funny. And the second series is a kind of parody of Tomorrow's World. It also has the most incredible cast of comedians and actors who went on to be very successful, including Olivia Colman. So I would recommend getting hold of that. I think you can still get it on DVD or you can find it on YouTube. Robert also wrote on the Peter Serafinowicz show. He's written some episodes of Staff Let's Flats and he's written for South Park as well. And he's been a script editor on shows including Peep Show, Him and Her, The Inbetweeners and The IT Crowd. So his CV really does take in a lot of the best British comedy of the last 15, 20 years. He also wrote the Time Waster letters under the pen name Robin Cooper. They were deeply weird, very funny spoof letters written to all sorts of companies and public bodies, from the British Halibut Association to IKEA. One thing I really appreciated talking to Robert is that he got into the industry in his sort of mid to late 20s, several years after graduating, and without any special advantage. He just found really funny, inventive ways to catch the eye of the people that he wanted to work with. He talks about that in this interview, which I think will provide some inspiration to anyone who's wondering how to crack into TV comedy. And he also talks about the weird and wonderful world of that industry and how he writes Friday Night Dinner and why storyline should always come before the jokes. So over to Robert.
Well, I've got like a big sort of office spacey loft thing with a pinball for my ideas. Boom.
Yes.
And I've got you know, shelves and thingies.
And I can see that you've got a couple of framed posters. What are they?
Yeah, this is the only place in the house where I put like worky things. There's Look Around You there. And there's a Friday Night Dinner one there. Yeah. And then there's a couple of, well, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. So when you're working on, say, Friday Night Dinner, what's your sort of routine? And would you talk me through how it works? I mean, do you write the first draft of all the episodes first and then does it go to other people? And then is there a bit of editing and back and forth, or how do you work?
Well, before lockdown, which is when we were making the show, editing just up to lockdown. So I write in the British Library, like, twice a week I probably write at home. 3 days I'll write in the British Library. Probably aim to start 9:30. I don't know. I kind of try and see if I can get 6 hours sort of concentrated writing, if I can. Sometimes it's impossible. So in terms of like drafts, so okay, for a series, what I would do, I think every writer you'll notice is different. So I don't map out the series. So with Friday Night Dinner, for example, there aren't like major arcs. You can kind of watch them like any order, I suppose. But there's sort of mini arcs and things like that. This last series had a mini arc. We're leading up to an end with their girlfriends coming and then this big reveal at the end that they were living in space. No. And so I normally just think of like, I spend about a month first. So writing period will be about 7 months. So a month of kind of mucking around, just literally mucking around, thinking of sort of silly ideas and adding it to my all ideas list. And that's stuff I've overheard, funny stories I've heard from people, funny things my mum says, my dad says, I shove them all in.
And, do you have like a list on your phone or something where you're just constantly making notes?
Yeah, if there's something funny happens, it goes in my phone. Yeah, like when my dad said, for example, he hurt himself and he said, I wish I never had a body. I was like, well, that's going in. I mean, that's got to go in. That's brilliant. And I know what he means. Like when you stub your toe, if I stub my toe, in my head, since I was a kid, I don't know if other people say this, but I say to myself, I wish I was dead, I wish I was dead, I wish I was dead. And when the pain subsides in my head, I then say, I wish I wasn't dead. That's my brain there. So I have like a really nice team. I have like Caroline Leddy, who's an incredible exec producer. Now she's like one of the, like, I'd say unsung heroes of British comedy. So she produced Brass Eye, she developed Smack the Pony, Green Wing. She exec produced In Between Us, Derry Girls. She used to run Channel 4 Comedy. And she's my sort of creative person I can bounce ideas off. Like, here's my thoughts, what do you think? And she's the one that gives me notes, which is what I want. And I have another exec producer, Kenton Allen, who's great as well. He's fantastic, but he's slightly more big picture, you know, and more businessy things as well, which is great. So he's less involved the day-to-day, so then I can give a script to him and who have like even more fresh eyes. But in terms of the actual writing it, I think like I need to know like a good strong idea. So Dad Buys a Caravan was episode one of this series. I thought, well, that's going to be funny. I know that's going to be visually funny, great. And I need to write like a really strong opening, and I also need to know my ending. I need to know like where it's going and some of the kind of things in the middle. And then I kind of like, I don't really plot it all out. I kind of start writing. But what I've been doing over the years is whenever I have a good idea, I just think something's going to be funny, I'll, rather than going, okay, this will be a funny scene, and make notes, you know, little notes, I'll write the actual whole scene. And I just bank all my scenes. And I realise, oh, when I start a new series, I've got like 40 scenes. That could slot in there. That could slot in there with a bit of editing. So sometimes like episodes come in shape and, oh, that could fit with that. So like a jigsaw thing. So I think writing scenes is in my first month is kind of really helpful. Random scenes of random ideas I have. And then I feel like I've already started writing. It eases me into it all. And so once I got to the end, I kind of, some people write like from the beginning to the end and just, it doesn't matter. It's a splurge and it's get to the end. That's great. I sort of can't do that. I have to make it for me like perfect. So I have to, I keep going over the beginning because it's all about the rhythm and melody for me. And then he said pretentiously, and then when I get to the end, like, and I'm really happy with it, that's when I'll send it to Caroline and I go, okay, I've done a draft now. And that's normally about after about a month, but it'll be, you know, several drafts, like 20 drafts to get to there. And then I'll get my notes, you know, 50 notes, and I'll do them all because they're always right. And then I'll get 20 notes back, then 5 notes back. And then here's my draft. It's ready. And then I'll move on. That's kind of how it works.
And then presumably there's also a bit of tweaking that actually goes on during filming.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, not much during filming. It's kind of right up to filming. We do a big read through with everyone. So there's tweaking then and notes. And in rehearsal, we rehearse each episode for a day. So things change in rehearsal. And then kind of when we go in filming, not much does change. It changes like when we'll do like just before a scene, we'll do a quick read through with everyone or put it on its feet. Little words might change. Sometimes you're filming and you're going, oh, we'll never finish this scene. I'll have to rewrite a scene and make it shorter. But yeah, not much changes actually on the day. It's not improv-y, okay, to show.
Am I right in thinking the 6 series now of Friday Night Dinner? Yeah. So that's how many episodes per series?
There's 6. Although series 2 had 7. We had a Christmas special.
Okay. So you've done a lot of episodes and you've got a very, you've got quite a sort of rigid, situation
for Fred. The house.
Yeah, yeah, they're all in the house. It's always Friday night. It's always dinner.
Yeah. It's always the same show.
And it's not like a, I mean, you have had new characters come in.
Sure.
But it's not as perhaps as easy to do that as it might be in an office or some kind of other scenario. So, I mean, is that faintly terrifying to have to keep coming up with new things that might be going on?
It is a bit terrifying. Each time I was going, oh, God, how am I going to write another series? And then I think with this one, I relaxed a bit. I thought, I've done 5, managed to do it in, like, this amount of weeks. I bet I can do it. And I kind of relax a little. Normally it's blind panic. Also, like, being stupid, I like, you know, when I'm bored, I've worked out how many days does it take me to... I've worked it out mathematically. So it's like 22 days of writing kind of gets me to an... And I plot it all out like that. And I have my deadlines. Yeah. And then I've like... And then I card it. I put it on my wall. Okay, this is your deadline. And so once they got a deadline, it's... I mean, sure, everyone says it's deadlines, isn't it, that gets it done?
Yeah, definitely. That definitely helps me. I actually got somebody to set me a fake deadline recently for something because I just knew I wasn't going to do it wasn't a deadline.
And is it going to happen? Have you done it yet? Or is
yeah,
it about to happen?
I met the first one. Now I've made him give me another deadline. But is there a certain pleasure to that? Because I think you've amassed quite a lot of running jokes now in Friday Night Dinner, haven't you? And I wondered whether there's a certain satisfaction to that, because it's sort of a call out to the audience, isn't it? Every time the dad wanders in with no top on.
Yeah.
It's sort of a...
That came from my dad not doing that as I grew up. You know, he didn't used to wear a top when it was hot, and he always said he was boiling. And that was one of the hooks for me early on. Just thought, well, if I'm going to set it in a house, a family, it could look quite, you know, you'd flick on. I remember like One Foot on the Grave as a kid, you know, watching that sometimes. Or when it used to be on, I used to think, oh, that looks a bit dull. What is that? Until I actually watched it, realised, oh, this is actually a weird show. I thought, well, if it's just a family... It could, like, you could flick and go, oh, is that going to be a boring family comedy? And I just remember thinking, yeah, the dad shouldn't wear the top much. Because I think if you suddenly see the man, just grown man with no top on in the house, it's immediately, what is that? And I like the fact that it's just normal in that house. And I think everyone can kind of relate to the fact that, well, we might not do that in our house, you know. But, you know, my mum, you know, there might be people that their mother never wears a top, joking. But they have their own thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some weird thing. Yeah, like someone told me that their dad used to come home from work, put his pyjamas on, right? Pyjama, and then put his clothes back over his pyjamas. I don't know why, but that, she said, that's what he used to do. And she can't remember why he did it. It was just the thing dad did.
Yeah.
He put his pyjamas on and put his clothes on top of his pyjamas. That is odd.
When did you start writing? What was your kind of first entry into the world of comedy writing?
That's a good one. I used to play guitar. I learned guitar and I love guitar. And I used to want to be a guitarist. And I used to play in a band. We never did anything. And we used to just argue the whole time. And then one day I thought, I don't want to do this anymore because it's too much arguing. And it was the time when Alan Partridge was on the radio. It was in the 90s. And I remember, or it was the day-to-day Chris Morris thing, you know, it was called On the Hour. It was around that time, and I remember hearing that and thinking, because I always loved being silly and mucking about, and so that was my other love, music and that. And I remember thinking, oh, I should do something with this. This is what I should do. And so I didn't know anyone in TV, but it was something like Mum's friend's friend's son or something like that. Or brother or uncle worked with Esther Anson on TV, right? And she was this, you know, presenter of these unbelievably dull programmes. And I think I had a meeting with him. I think we went to watch the news being filmed, which was also, I found, quite boring. But anyway, but he told me, just, he didn't know anything about comedy, but he said, just write to producers of comedy shows you like. I didn't even know what a producer was.
Sorry, how old were you at this point?
I was 12. I was about 26, 25.
And had you done a degree?
I'd done a degree in French and Italian for some reason.
Okay, so not relevant to your ultimate
career. No, totally. And all I did was just play guitar and muck around and do nothing.
Okay. So how were you earning a living at this? How did you get to 26?
I worked in like various like temp jobs and things like that.
Okay.
And I worked in a warehouse, and I worked in a post room for a bit.
Okay.
Was it Iceland? Maybe it was Iceland, something like that. Yeah, just a shoe shop, different places. And and then I started writing. So my first bit of writing, as in comedy writing, was my application to get into TV. So I thought, how am I going to get a job in TV? And I remember I wrote to people like Peter Richardson, who ran the Comic Strip Presents, and I decided what I would do would be to write a fake CV, so it looked normal, Robert Parr age, blah, blah, blah. And then it said, like, in whatever year it was, I was the sole survivor of an air crash in British Columbia, Canada. And it goes, ripped by wolves, I spent the next 9 years learning the ways of the wild. But it looks really boring, and you get to the bottom. And then it's just, but really boringly presented of this crazy life. And then I was rescued by missionaries. And then I worked in a syrup factory, and I had an accident in boiling syrup. And then I had a reference from a hospital, like the burns unit. And it just looked, but it was so straight and boring. And that was also at the same time, maybe prior to that, I wrote to Steve Coogan. I wrote to Alan Partridge. When I heard the show, I thought, oh, I'd love to write on this show. I don't know how to get into it. So I wrote to him via his agent, but I sent my letters in gold envelopes, which I made, like bought gold paper, because I thought, well, then he'll remember me. And I wrote to him saying, dear Mr. Partridge, I'd love to work with you. I know you're a busy man, so I'll write your reply to me. So I wrote his reply in his voice, just so he might see that I could actually do him. And I sort of bombarded him with letters. And then I got a call from Patrick Marber, I think, who was his co-writer at the time. And he said, oh, your stuff's funny. And he said, we might be doing a TV show. I don't know if we're going to write with any new writers, but if you want to write a script, fine. So then I wrote a script, my first script for, you know, their TV show, before I didn't even know what it was. And that took me like 2 weeks. I'd never written a script before. And I sent it to them. And then they phoned back and said, we got lots of scripts. Yours was the funniest. I was like, oh, wow. We're not going to use it because we're not using anyone else's stuff, but well done. And then that gave me the thought, confidence. Maybe I can have a go at this. Yeah. And then I started getting interviews and I got a job at the Comic Strip Presents with Peter Richardson. And who's, I don't know if you know, but he's like a legend in comedy. And yeah, I remember when I got a job, I turned up there, he wanted to see me, and because he liked my CV about being reared by wolves. And when I went in, I heard him shout from the top, bring me the wolf man. And when I went in, I just liked the vibe in there. And I went to the top, and he was having a writing session with some other like people. And like some of them were smoking dope in there. And I thought, this place is cool, I want to work here. And he's very vague. So I just sat there with him saying, oh, your thing was very funny. Sit in the room. And then he said, bye at the end. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, you know, well, if you want to pop along another time, sure. So then I just turned up the next day. And then I said, Peter said that I'll be working here. So it caused a bit of confusion. But I sort of bullied my way in and I became like a runner on like crap money.
That's very ballsy.
And then worked there for, yeah. I just liked him, and I think he liked me. I think we sort of clicked a bit.
Did you feel like he was responding to your ballsiness?
Yeah, he was. I mean, yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I thought I really want to work in this place, because it was like walking to like a mini version of Sesame Street. It was really run down and rickety, and just loads of funny arty people were just there hanging around and stuff. I thought, I don't know what this. I've never been in a place like this. I want to. Yeah, so I worked there for 2 years with him, yeah. And I used to read his scripts when he wasn't around. I used to open up his cabinet, and he used to have them all handwritten, all the old comic strip things with Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders, all that. And I used to just read them, and I probably learned stuff from that, yeah.
Yeah.
He used to say, just don't worry about the funny, just make sure the story's right. So that was always good.
What does that mean?
Well, just make sure, like with Friday Night Dinner, say, for example, for me the main thing is getting the story right, like, what is the story? You know, it's okay being funny, but if there's no story, nothing happens and the thing doesn't lead to another thing, people will turn over. And it's sort of also having the confidence to think, okay, it will be funny, but you just got to make sure that when they watch it, there's a story and it keeps them watching and they want to watch more, kind of that. I think that's what he meant.
And then the funniness can come afterwards.
Late, don't worry about the funny. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, eventually you've got to worry about the funny, otherwise you're writing a poor drama.
And you then became a commissioning editor at Channel 4, is that right? Have I got that right?
I did, that was a random... that was... When was that? I can't remember, it was in 2000. I did that for a bit. Why did I do that? I just made, like, a short film of Look Around You with Peter...
Is that the Calcium pilot?
Yeah, we made, like, a short film. We suddenly... Yeah, we thought we were going to make a short... Well, we thought we'd, like... We realised that we were like obsessed with these old schools and colleges programmes that you're forced to watch as a kid at school, or in the middle of the night, or in the morning when you were sick or something off school. They'd just be on there really trippy. And we started just writing one. Then we go, no, let's just make one. So then his friend Tim Kirkby, who's an incredible director, he does loads of amazing things now. we just got together and a bunch of random people and brilliant people who all like done really well now, and we just made this mad film for no reason. And then we had a big screening and invited all the people we admire in comedy. It was basically, we thought if we're going to make a short film, it should be something, because often people go, I made a short film, and people internally go, oh, I don't really want to watch that. But we thought, well, if it's the world's first comedy about calcium, people might go, what is that? You know, so that's what we wanted to do. And we didn't tell people what it was at all. And it was kind of went down well. We never thought of it as a TV show. And so I made that. And then I got a job randomly at Channel 4. They asked me to come in, and I thought, oh, it'd be quite fun here, I reckon. It's pretty creative. And then after like a few months, we also like behind Channel 4's back, I think, really. We pitched the show, Look Around to BBC. Something, and people said, why don't you? And they gave us a series. So then I left Channel 4 for like 4 months and then went back to Channel 4. And then I left again when we got Series 2 commissioned, which was weird. Yeah.
So Look Around You. Yeah, that calcium pilot, I mean, I think it's so good because it's so convincing. I was watching it over the weekend, and it's so absurd, but there are quite a few moments where I was like, is that a bit true? Is it true yeah, that we get calcium from grinding up human teeth? That doesn't seem right, but it's sort of
might be true.
And some of the experiments and stuff, and it's so deadpan, but was it just completely hilarious to work on? I mean, it seems
that was never really our pilot. That was just our film for fun. We never thought about it because we thought, well, obviously it's not going to be a TV show because it's so weird. So when the BBC said we were interested, and we went in and said, we've got these 10-minute slots, and we give you 6. I said, let's have 10, please. And they said, all right, 8. I went, okay, which is good. See, that's another thing. If you don't ask, you don't get. It's true. And they kind of like that. But we kind of worked out, how do we make this kind of free-form film, well, it's pretty free-form, into like a bit more structured thing for a TV audience, as opposed to people sitting in a cinema or watching at home, stoned on a video, like a short film. We're going to watch a short film, as opposed to this is on in between shows on TV. How do I keep people watching? We kind of structured it a bit more for the TV show. But yeah, I mean, we were, yeah, filming it was, yeah, it was the most fun I've ever had making anything ever, because we were filming in, when we did the series, we were filming in the basement of Talkback, the company. It was really grotty down there, which we liked, and because the show's really grotty. And the background is this blue, the lab is this blue turquoise colour, which we had like this blue sheet of paper, which we were staring at for, you know, 5 weeks, going insane. And then it would just be, okay, next shot, there's the test tube, and the finger comes in and points at the test tube and cap. So you go a bit insane. We did a day of pickup, so it was just shots of bottles, close up on the bottle was taken out. And yeah, that was mad. But because you do go a bit insane, you realise this is ridiculous, and are people going to get it, or are they going to like it, because it's pretty out there and extreme, you know. But we also, the concept behind the making of it, we always thought, well, if we make it as if we were making an educational programme, it's all about information, you know, we don't steer away from that, and we don't do many takes because they wouldn't have had loads of film, we shot it on film, you know, then we'll get it right, hopefully. Yeah,
it's fun. It feels like it's part of a kind of group of slightly weird comedy of around that time, and I suppose stuff like Brass Eye would fall in, the Day to Day and stuff would fall into that as well, quite surreal. And I can't really think of very much nowadays that has quite that same kind of feel to it. I don't know. Do you think it was a moment?
I think there was a specific time. I think there was a sort of music around then as well that a lot of us were listening to. There's a lot of Warp Records music, the Boards of Canada, Aphex Twin. I think some of that went into people's subconscious that were making shows like that at the time. Well, that's my theory anyway. I think there's a sort of weird crossover.
Actually, thinking about it,
I think there was a bit of that.
There's still, I was thinking about Dear Joan, you know, Dear Joan and Jerrica, the
Sure.
Podcast.
Julia Davis.
Yeah, yeah, I feel like incredible. Anything Julia Davis does still has that kind of slightly
nauseous feel
to it.
She's fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
So the second series of Look Around You, you sort of moved on slightly from the educational films and now it was like a kind of Tomorrow's World spoof.
That's it. I'm sorry, I'm just moving my bit around. Yeah, that was because... we tried to get a second series. You know, it did, you know, this first series did well and was nominated for this and that, blah, blah, blah. Great. And then they go, well, this is for just new things, this 10 minute slot. So we were gutted because we wanted to just make those forever. I mean, I'd still make those forever. And then I just badgered away at them for like 2 years. Please can we have a second series? Please can we? No. And they go, well, then there was a breakthrough. Like I said, well, we're looking at 30 minute slots. Okay, we'll do that. I said, but we want people in it as opposed to just sort of, you know, the lower half of someone's body and a finger, you know, and test tubes. So originally we were going to do, I didn't realise this, I found the proposal, it was going to be like learning modules. So there'll be like a 30 minute, like a learning zone, which would have been fun, I think. And then in the end, we decided on a kind of, let's change it a bit. Let's do a like Tomorrow's World thing, whether that was the right idea or not, I don't know. And then they said yes to that. Yeah.
It's got an incredible cast. I mean, I don't know how many of those people, some of them were certainly already very, pretty successful, I think, and now are like hugely successful. I mean, you know, like...
Yeah, Olivia Colman.
Olivia Colman. She's done well. David Mitchell, Simon Pegg, Kevin Eldon, Sarah Alexander, David Walliams. I was also watching the one where they have Tchaikovsky's Ghost come on.
That was Harry Enfield.
And I was like,
yeah.
Is that Harry? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he's incredible. Yeah, he's so funny.
Do you think... It feels, looking at your work and looking at all the things that you've been involved in over the years, there's such a community in the comedy world, I think, and it feels like, you see the same people obviously working together again and on different projects over the years and everything. Do you feel like there's a sort of, that element of community plays a big part in your industry?
Probably, particularly, maybe like then more than now, because like people then sort of move on a bit. I think there was a whole sort of bunch of us that knew each other, and there'll be like a younger bunch now, there is, you know, that know each other and they do that. And then after a while, you kind of move on a bit. And so, but I imagine if I did something and I wanted to work with those people again, fingers crossed they'd say yes, you know what I mean? But there was a kind of like, yeah, you're probably a bit hungrier then as well, you know, you're a bit younger and stuff like that. That sounds awful, but yeah, and you're up for things, you know.
Yeah. Do you think, I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to solve the problems of the industry, but I just think that there are probably people who want to get in, like you actually back then, who are not well connected already and don't know anybody in television and probably look at it and just think this is like an impossible club. What do you advise young people who want to get into comedy?
Well, now it's kind of like, I don't know if it's easy or not, but you can just make stuff. You know, there's just so many funny people making stuff and sticking it on YouTube or wherever. You know, probably if you can make stuff, but obviously not everyone wants to make stuff. I think it's, if you have a brilliant script, you know, really funny script that's just brilliant, you've got a pretty good chance of getting noticed. You know, if it's really... when someone receives it and reads it and it's like, oh, I haven't heard this kind of voice. It's always about voice, isn't it? About someone's take on things, I think. So if someone's got a great take on something, it's, who's this person? You know? Yeah, I remember like, there's a guy called Adrian Gray who sent me something about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, some mini clip. And I hadn't heard of him before, he's new. And he was just funny. He just had some, often like people, someone get in touch and sometimes they're brilliant. And I'm not saying I helped him in any way, but just, he just said, carry on making things. He would have anyway. And he's doing really well. And he's making fantastic stuff now that's really getting noticed. He's got an agent. So, and sometimes you might need people to say, yeah, it's really good. Because I always needed that. You know, when I wrote this silly script for Steve Coogan years ago, I got them, they phoned me and said, I really liked it. That meant so much that I was like, oh my God, wow. Okay, because I think if you're a funny person, you sort of know you're funny, because growing up, you make people laugh a bit and you're silly. But when someone you really look up to who's in that industry says, oh, that was good, then you do go, okay, oh, maybe I can actually have a go. I think that all helps people telling you, yeah, go for it, or
yeah,
your stuff's funny. That, I think you kind of need that. Sad, isn't it, being told you're funny? You need to be told.
Have you ever had any sort of inventive approaches from people along the lines of your letter that you wrote in about being raised by wolves?
I probably got lots at Channel 4, like people sent chocolate bar, funny chocolate bars with graphics printed on them. Yeah, it was funny, Channel 4, like funny, yeah, it was, apropos of nothing, but it was quite funny. Like the best meeting I ever had, there was these two writers, really funny writers, Mark Evans and James Backman. They used to work together and I knew them really well. And they came in for a chat to pitch me something or something. And they're like, you know, they were buddies. So it's kind of, it's not awkward. It's just, okay, this is a situation. And nothing, you know, they pitched me a couple of ideas and nothing happened. And then there was like a silence for like 20 seconds. And I said, oh, wouldn't it be funny if we sat here in silence for 2 minutes now? And then we just did. And then the meeting ended, I said, wouldn't it be funny if we had a meeting for 20 minutes and we all sat here in silence? And they laughed. Anyway, they left, and then the next day, like the comedy department's assistant said to me, oh, Mark and James phoned, they said you wanted to have another meeting, a 20-minute meeting with them. I realised. I went, oh, yeah. What? Yeah, book it in next week. So I didn't speak to them or text them or anything up until then, but I knew what it meant. And so they turned out, and I saw them walk down the corridor, they waved at me, I waved at them. They came into the office, it was a glass-fronted office, so you can look right in. We nodded at each other. One of them took off their watch, put their stopwatch on, and we sat together, three of us, around a little table in absolute silence for 20 minutes. It was like weird at first, because you sort of go into your mind like, oh, this is so weird. People were walking, I remember my boss walking past and stuff. And 20 minutes later, the watch went beep, beep, and they got up, we shook hands, and they left. And then I waited about 3 minutes and sent them both blank texts. It's the best meeting. That is the best meeting I've ever had in my life. It was fantastic.
So yeah, looking at your sort of CV, you've been involved, it sort of felt to me as though you've been involved in about half of the best sitcoms for the last, you know,
20 years.
None of the worst. You know, just incredible CV, but not always as a writer. You were a producer on a couple of series of Peep Show, and then you were a script editor on The Inbetweeners and The IT Crowd.
Yeah.
So what does being a script editor involve, and where is the line between being a script editor and being a writer?
Oh, well, a script editor is not a writer. So I've done like quite a few like script editing jobs, mainly with like buddies and things like that. It's fun. So it's like, say, with The Inbetweeners, it's not similar to Friday Night Dinner, but a lot of it is based on their like growing up, and they want silly stories. And so a lot of it early on is like, can you come in for an ideas meeting? Here's some, have you got any funny stories? And I give them some funny stories. Similarly with Peep Show, there's a lot of that. And then it's coming for a storyline meeting. Here are the storylines. Can we have your notes? And let's do a storyline day. And you listen to their ideas and suggest things. And you're just a kind of spare
sort of pair of brainstormer,
ears, eyes and body. Yeah, there's that. And then it's, okay, here's the first draft of a script. And then you're reading it, and then you're giving them, you know, 30 notes. So, oh, this is really funny, blah, blah, blah. The opening, oh, I thought it was a bit confusing. I didn't quite understand. Would this be the right word to use here? How about that? Oh, is this the, you know, there's a lot of it is like clarity. Well, I understand this when I'm watching it, trying to think of it like that. I felt like this scene here, do we need this scene? Or it's a little bit long. Or I think you need a punchline here, you know. A lot of Peep Show, when you're producing it, you're working with, you know, the best writers in the country, stroke world, Sam and Jesse. And a lot of it used to be sometimes like the last line, can we make a even funnier punchline, you know, and they'd give you 10 and they'd all be good. And a lot of it is that, trying to make the last line of a scene really funny. There's a lot of stuff like that, sometimes suggesting things, and it's going through several drafts like that. And then it's going to the edit and giving, like, I'd go along with, and then it would be me, then it would be a channel, like two people from the channel probably, and the writers, and you go, and then you give your notes, which I call criticisms, but in a good way, because it's good but it's funny. And we do a criticism session, and you go through, this bit was a bit long, blah 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 blah. That's kind of your job, really. It's fun.
Yeah. Do you think all of that work has been helpful now that you've come to do Friday? I know that you've been doing Friday Night Dinner for ages.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, I think it's helped. Working with like different writers as well, lots, definitely helped. Yeah. Yeah. And being in loads of edits for years, that helps. Just, you know, trying to sort of convey quickly what you're trying to say, I think. I mean, not every show is the same, but generally, comedically, you know, and making sure it's, the piece has got a rhythm and people aren't going to turn over half the time.
Yeah. Let's talk about the time waster letters, which are so funny. So you published your first book of those in 2004, I think.
I did Time Waster Letters, I did Return of the Time Waster Letters, and then I did a sort of novel based on the character. So this is like Robin Cooper, who's my pseudonym I did, which was like I started writing mad letters to companies and associations and hobby groups. And the third one was the Time Waster Diaries. It was a year in the life, so it was like a kind of novel.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was such fun doing those. Oh, it was madness.
How did you start writing these mad letters to
people? I think I've always written sort of insane letters. I mean, it's how I sort of got into TV. But I think I got sent a gardening book, a gardening brochure in like 1999. And I didn't have a garden. And then I wrote back and I said that I was a designer of garden equipment, and I designed scarecrows made from beef. I have a range of scarecrows made from beef. Would you like be interested? And then I didn't think they'd write back. And then they wrote back and they go, "We thank you for your letter. I assume there must be a typo there because it says scarecrows made from beef." So I thought, brilliant. So I wrote back and said, "Of course, I'm so sorry. It should, of course, say scarecrows made from beel, B-E-E-L, no such word." And then they were right back, "Thank you, I'd be interested in your Beale scarecrows." This is brilliant. So then I did my stupid drawings. And I thought, oh, this is great. And then I started writing for more. And then where I was working, Granada TV, they had like a library there. And they had this book, which was Directory of British Trade Associations and Hobby Groups. It was massive. And I photocopied.
Were you like, bingo?
600... So yeah, 600 pages. See, I didn't want like my boss to see me. I was constantly, yeah, it was bingo. And then I would just like pick a page and go, British Tug of War Society. You know, this the British Spoon Collectors Club. And it was just, I'll send loads. And that, and I became, I mean, I was so addicted to that. And it was brilliant. It just meant I got posts the whole time.
Do you think that you're missing some sort of embarrassment, Jean? Because honestly, when I read the Time Waster letters, they're hilarious, but I almost can't bear to read them. They make me feel so embarrassed.
I was in sometimes, so normally when I write them, they're different takes. So sometimes I purposely do them to embarrass myself. So I type in their like ridiculous name, you know, the British Thimble Collectors Club and their address. And then sometimes I would go, okay, this one's going to be insane. And I would just write total stream of consciousness, utter lunacy, you know, some quotes that I've made up. And privy thee, sir, I'm delighted I've been given your name by Lady Grasmere, or some nonsense. And yeah, and sometimes I would do it that I know it's embarrassing and cringing reading, you know. And then I would then edit it. I write a kind of splurge, and I go, oh my God, that is too mad. They won't reply to that one. So sometimes I would make them a bit more first one, okay. I'll make it not too mad to the reply. And then sometimes I go, no, fuck it, I'm just going to make this one insane. Because sometimes they did reply to the insane ones. But, and it was such... Yeah, I just would do it. And then Then I started working out how many I would need to make a book. Because at first I sort of used to print them up and pass them to buddies. And then they get passed around and people said, I really like them. And then I got rejected from... I thought, I'm going to try and get these published. And they got rejected from everywhere, fine. And then I just kept writing them, and I kept thinking, I'm going to get this published one day, surely, no, because they're so silly. I just felt they would end up being published, I don't know why. And I think what helped was, like, a lot of comedy people read it, and someone said, why don't you ask them to give you a quote that might help at least a publisher, you know, pick it up? And I found that quite embarrassing, asking people. But then
that embarrassed
you. That embarrassed me, like, oh, you know, and so people did. And then that helped me. Like, I had a new agent and said, who had tried before, I think. And I think a publisher came in and said, oh, who are these funny people who have given this quote? And I think that definitely helped get it read and taken a bit more seriously.
I was thinking, it actually, reading some of them reminded me of the kind of letters that you get at a newspaper. Like, yeah, I have sure, had you are, like, slightly
insane sanity. Yeah, a lot of it is based on those kind of letters I used to get sent, those, or I'll read those kind of letters, you know, in newspapers and things like, just slightly wrong.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. I was going to say, I had one a few months ago that I kept. It was a letter somebody wrote to the Times. He was an older man, and the Times had published a photo of me where I had short hair, and it was, I felt, not a very flattering photo, but I have no say over this. They just use what they want. And he wrote in to express his deep disappointment with my hairstyle. He said he felt that it was irresponsible of the Times to encourage women to get their hair cut short, because it was clearly less attractive than women with long hair. And it went on for about two sides, and it was really serious, just completely bonkers.
And you kept it?
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, I kept it. Were you surprised by how patiently people replied to those letters? And some of them got such nice responses, considering how mad they were.
Yeah, some of them went on for like 6 months, back and forth, 10 letters between us. It was once it got going, like a good series, they'd done 3 letters, send 3 back. It was like, oh, I want to keep this going. So it was the balance. Is this the letter that's going to tip them over the edge? And also, I want to have a good ending. I want there to be sort of thing that letter could be the end, even if it's one I've sent and they haven't replied, you know. So it got kind of harder the longer a series went, to keep it going and getting the right balance. And as they went, I started thinking of a narrative where it could go, hopefully. I want to get to here, you know. yeah, one of my favourite bits, not to quote myself, but I am, but it was in the second book. It was like, I written to the British UFO Association, or something. I think they called Bufora or something. And I said that my wife and I had seen this weird pink light in the sky or something, and it was very strange or whatever, it's a UFO, and it like burnt a hole in our car, I can't remember. And they sent me a questionnaire to fill in. It's a standard one they have, it's really long, and they go, apart from the sighting, was did anything else strange happen? And I said something like, what was it? I said something like, not really, but we did suddenly see quite a lot of crows in the sky, about 1,000. I don't know why that always made me laugh writing that. About 1,000. Just suddenly there's 1,000 crows. That always made me laugh writing that.
That's really good.
Almost one of my favourite things, that bit. About 1,000. Suddenly there's 1,000 crows.
Can you remember any moments, maybe early on in your career, where you learnt something that you think has really improved your writing?
No. I remember it told me about, you know, early on, like things being episodic and not really understanding in a script. So meaning when you're writing a script, things are like and then, meaning like stuff happens, as opposed to like you should be able to, a scene should be able to end and then you should be able to go therefore, you know, or but. I think that's two. But that might be a South Park thing. I learned later from their thing, which was that every scene should end with, you could say, but. But this could happen. Or therefore, because of this, as opposed to, and then.
Sorry, so do you mean like, as in every scene needs to play a role in moving the story along, or?
Yeah, so the end of a scene, you should be able to theoretically say, I mean, it depends what you're doing, but, you know, you can throw all this out the window, but generally, like, scene ends, and because of what's happening in the scene, therefore this happens, just to move a scene along to the next scene, rather than this is funny, and then, oh, that's another scene, and that's another scene, because sometimes those are the ones that I often end up cutting, go, hold on, this is really funny, this scene, but it doesn't move anything on, and I don't have the time, unfortunately, even though it's really funny. We did that in the series, we had a really funny, I never do it, but I did put the scene up on Twitter, because it was a scene we wrote in the episode 1 of series 6, which is Dad buying a caravan, and they're at dinner and he tells them a story about his best holiday ever was going on a caravan in the middle of some field in Norfolk, and they were taking the piss out of him because his caravan's disgusting, and he said he'd love to take the whole family there one day or whatever, you know, and teasing him and blah blah blah, but he said, you know, his best holiday ever was going in a caravan with his uncle years ago. And like, and mum's under her breath is like, better than our honeymoon type thing. And then it transpires, he went with his uncle and he said we had an amazing time. You know, we milked cows, we got, you know, butter from the farmer. And there's this wonderful horse in the field who's so friendly, he could eat out of your hand. And they're like, not really listening to him yet. And he just goes, but then it just turned bad. So they're like, bad. And he says, yeah, Uncle Saul was feeding and he must have got spooked or something because it bit off two of his fingers. It bit off his uncle. Oh my God, you never told us that. And it's like, you never asked. It bit your uncle's fingers off. Yeah, and he had, it was awful, went bad, and they had to amputate. They amputated his fingers. Oh, his hand. He amputated his arm at the elbow. And that's the story that comes out, that that was his best. And he said, that's your best holiday ever. So yeah, well, apart from it biting his fingers, it was lovely. He said something like, I had to spend the rest of the holiday with his uncle in hospital. His uncle was in constant agony. And it was a funny, and Paul Ritter did it brilliantly. And then we watched it all back, the episode, the first time, you know. And we realised, that's really funny, that bit. We all like, you know, and go, but doesn't move the story on, so it just went snip straight away.
God.
So I think that taught me, like, to be quite ruthless like that. You just have to go, nope.
Yeah.
But you must find that in your writing, like, oh, yeah. I really like this, but it's just, what is it?
Yeah, and also I think you often get to a point sometimes where you're hanging on to something that you wrote at the beginning that you really liked and felt really good about, yeah. And it sort of makes it through quite a few edits because you're so reluctant to get rid of it. And then, yeah, I mean, I think I've definitely, that is something you get better at over years of just realizing, get over it, you know.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I want to keep it. Oh, it's gonna. Your voice goes, it's gonna go anyway. So you might as well just do it now. Oh, okay.
So looking back at your career, what are you proudest of?
This chat.
Oh, I hoped you'd say that.
I know, it's a nice chat. I don't know. Probably, yeah. Probably look around you. Series one.
Why? What is it about that has a special place?
Because it also represents a time of lunacy and having a lot of, like, time to do stuff as well. We couldn't believe we were making something, because you couldn't really give the scripts into BBC for notes, because what are they going to say? This one's about sulfur. What are they going to, you know, it's just all gibberish anyway. And yeah, it was just a fun, silly time making an insane programme that somehow ended up on TV at like 9:30 on BBC Two. Yeah, and me and Peter working together, that was just like fun. We were really in a zone and we were obsessed with this thing. And just, it was always like detail, like everything had to be right down to the right colour. And also we did the music together and that was lovely. So it was all, yeah, it was brilliant fun. It was brilliant fun.
That was Robert Popper, and you can see a lot of his sitcom Friday Night Dinner on All Four and even more of it on Netflix. And I would also really recommend that you dig out Look Around You if you haven't seen it before. I have two more brilliant guests coming up this series. I'm very excited for you to hear them and so grateful to everyone who's listened so far and all of you who've got in touch on Twitter and Instagram. See you next time.